probably not a bad idea. Because
I don't know if it's a bad idea. I just tell you that every year counts like five. That's all. Like you look at me right now and you wouldn't believe I'm 25. I am.
You're actually looking younger, if that's possible.
Yeah.
Maybe having kids and running a startup is actually the way, in the route to eternal life is actually,
I mean, 100%.
Max it out.
I would strongly recommend to do this to anyone that's thinking that either having kids or starting a business is a good idea. You should do it at the same time. That's the best cocktail. Yeah.
No, get 100%. All the bad ideas together. Do them all at once.
Oh, my God. Yeah. Yeah, yeah,
that is the way. That is the way. No, but like I say, I think there probably is never a good time for either of these ideas, right? And if you just stayed and waited for the moment, it just never is going to happen. So
completely agree. I think you on the business side of things, you don't decide when you have a good idea, and when it comes, you just need to go with it. And like you said, I think there might be better moments than others, but there's no ideal moment. And on the kid side, I would like to think that most of the time, or the ideal scenario is that you plan on doing it and you're a little bit prepared psychologically for what's about to come. But I think in both cases, I had a discussion with another founder here in Copenhagen last week who has young kids as well. I think on both cases, society is not really truly honest about what it is, and now exhausting. You know, there's this romanticized idea of like starting your own business, you're going to be free, it's going to be amazing and everything. It's great, but it's hard and it's exhausting, and just I think a lot of similarities with having kids.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd be interested, folks, for the parents out there. I mean, when you were having kids, was it like entirely fully planned out? Was it like, did you have like a Gantt chart sorted out or something? Or did it just happen? I mean, sometimes it happens, right? Without necessarily, you know, overly planning. Of course, you know, you're with your partner, things happen. Of course they do. Now, you know, nature takes its own path. So yeah, I mean, having the kids and then having to juggle that along with work and, you know, new projects, I think that's all part of the thing. And in fact, probably something underrated in terms of how we think about people in teams, because teams are often, I think, idealized purely for the one atomic individual. Like, we design it as if the person actually has no relationships outside of work at all. You know, when you think about the old commute idea, you think about the 9 to 5, like solid period of time in the office, like we're not calculating at all whether this person has any kind of responsibilities at home. We certainly don't cater for someone who might become pregnant and then need to have do intensive primary childcare after birth. We don't, this is not part of the design of work. No. So, you know, maybe this new future that we're looking down, it may be an opportunity for us to rethink this, and to, you know, have more defaults, have more personas, if you like. We talk about it in marketing all the time. We need to have multiple personas to market to different people. Guess what? The world of work has just one persona. It's basically 25-year-old single dude. Nothing else
white.
To do
you
with
forgot
this
white.
Time.
25-year-old white dude. Yeah,
that's right. It's design. That's the default. And that person, you know, you can break him down. You can, you know, he's going to do what you need him to do. There's no external responsibilities, etc., etc. And all the entire work, the career trajectory, the learning, all the plans are designed around this persona. And of course, different people don't fit in with that, which is why, of course, those people that don't fit in precisely with it will have additional struggles. They're not the game is not the same, and they end up having a handicap. So, you know, maybe it's an opportunity for us to rethink. Like, let's bring in some different ways in which people live their lives and think about how work can be designed around multiple personas. Yeah. Anyway, this may be related to our chat, so let's save
a bit,
it for this.
Actually, I was thinking about this when you were saying it. It's actually kind of very much related to our chat.
Yeah, totally related, isn't it? So listen, welcome everybody to Brain Food Live on Air. We're bringing it to you every Friday like we always do. It is episode 129. I'm thinking it's always 130. I'm looking at it all the time, but every week it's less than 130. So I'm not sure I'm counting wrong, but one more week until 130. And we've got a really exciting show for you today. Another intellectual deep dive. What is the role of culture, quote unquote, in today's recruiting process? Is it something that we can do explicitly in terms of assessing for people, in terms of culture fit? is it something we do implicitly without saying it? Because nowadays you can't say it because it's potentially discriminatory, but we do it anyway. Or is it something that we actively strive not to do in order to make sure we de-bias the recruiting process? Now, the trajectory of culture fit, in my view of it, it was like had 5 years where everyone was doing culture fit recruiting. Like, this is the only way to recruit. You have to do a culture fit. More important than technical skills, more important than experience. We recruit on culture fit. And then it's suddenly become a toxic conversation to have. So this is the exploration of today. Anyway, let's do a quick sound check, as we always do. I want to make sure everyone can hear me okay. So Crowdcast, I think you can definitely hear me because you've been commenting in that way. Shout out to the folks on LinkedIn. If you're watching me on LinkedIn, good to see you. Give me a thumbs up. Give me one of those emojis that you want to that are available. Let me know whether you can hear me okay, or just comment and say, yes, Hong, I can hear you. We are also out. Oh, let me decline that. This is why I hope no one heard this.
Decline what?
I get inbound, man. I mean, I literally get inbounds today, and I was like, dude, I'm clearly on something. If you can hear me on, no. If you can hear me on Twitter, let me know. If you can hear me on Facebook, also let me know. And then we're all ready to go. Okay, so quick shout out to our sponsors today, by the way, which is Platypus.io. They are a company that do assessment based on team fit. So totally suitable for this topic. And of course, the sponsors always have to do a bit of work as well. We have the CEO of Platypus joining us today as the co-host, Nico Blia-Sylvester. How are you doing, Nico?
I am good. Thanks, Hong. Thanks for having me.
Great to see you, man.
I mean, it's always good to see you. It's always good to see you. Yeah, and they always do gifts. I mean, yeah, love those discussions, as you know.
I know. And this has always been one of the things that has been super interesting. I mean, you and I have got some, Nico has got some really interesting background. So he's actually an ex-recruiter who actually achieved a reasonably decent career in UK,
didn't you? You mean I survived?
Dude, you were the head of talent at Revolut and stuff like this, were you? And you're like,
head of recruitment at Trustpilot, at Unity, chief people officer at Revolut, among others companies.
Dude, yeah. These are like huge companies and huge brand names that have all since done better since you left, by the way.
Exactly. Culturally, at least, they're much better places now that I'm gone. But
No, but I tell you what makes you a rare beast, Nico, is because you've actually gone into a different path from a position of success. So you could have easily continued on the CPO route and, you know, work for bigger brands and all these types of stuff, but you stepped out and you went and did Platypus.io, a recruiting tech business, which, you know, obviously a journey I made as well. So massive respect for you on this. We'll talk about Platypus in a little bit deeper, but I think it's totally relevant, obviously, to stuff we're talking about today. Anyway, let's review the newsletter real quick, as something we always do. Did you read the newsletter last week? And if so, Nico, what was interesting in it?
Four things that I enjoyed reading that either made me laugh or made me think. The first one, do you discriminate against boring people? Genuinely made me laugh a lot because that's the type of humor I enjoy. And then actually I was super reflective about it because it's the whole... So first of all, how do you define what's boring and not boring? I'm probably boring to somebody else. We're all the boring person of someone, right? And then the discrimination around, again, I think very good for the discussion today. Is there a culture of boring, of not boring, and so on? So I think it was very well written. I mean, it made me laugh a lot. Tell me.
On this, I just shared the link onto the chat stream there. So please do have a look at this. Yeah. This is from Tim Sackett. I don't know if anybody doesn't know Tim Sackett, but he's a really famous writer, blogger, recruiter in the US. And he is, I call him out. He's a bit of a shit stirrer. But I love it because he always starts conversations that other people are not prepared to start. And I think if you read this post, it's kind of a critique on the overwhelming requirement to de-bias everything, which I think more or less we're all aligned with. Like I don't know anybody who's, you know, explicitly prejudiced in their work, in our work. I think everyone agrees that we need to give people a fair shot. Mm-hmm. But I think what Tim is saying is that, look, at what point do we stop this? Because there's a moment where we are still making potentially discriminatory decisions. Like, you've had an interview, you were just thoroughly bored by this person, because maybe they have a monotone way of delivering it. Perhaps they take too long to respond, do all of these things. Like, is that discriminatory? Is that an act of discrimination? I think it's a tough question to answer. I mean,
You push the idea a little bit further, is any kind of recruitment process just not an act of discrimination in a way?
Right. You are discriminating outside
you're filtering.
Outside of randomly hiring people, you're making a decision saying you're better, you're worse. I'm going to hire this person because I think they're better. And you don't actually know that. You've just got some guesses. You know, you've got some information that you think is worth your decision and you decide that's the case. But is it really the case? Almost anybody rejected might be able to argue the case to say, what degree of discrimination that is. Super, super interesting. And it's a philosophical topic, but it's written in a very funny way.
Very well written.
But you know what? It's worth thinking about. Like, what are the other factors that we put into play? What about someone who, you know, let's say you got a high fashion sense and someone walks in and they have a poor fashion sense or a fashion sense that is against yours, whatever. Are you not making potentially even subconscious decisions 100% to say, you know what? This person is not right fit for us, right?
Yeah, 100% so, you are. Very interesting read. Super good read.
Yeah. So check it out. Tim Sackett, a regular blogger. So you should totally check it out from there. Thank you, Markelos. That's a very good analysis on that. I think that's it's worth debating what discrimination really is. In terms of the Oxford English Dictionary, a part of the problem is that the definitions are different as well. The Americans use Merriam-Webster, for instance, and the Brits use Oxford English. The words don't mean the same. So discrimination, I think, does also mean prejudice in the English, Oxford English language. So it's not just like neutrally discriminating between two things. It is actually saying you are irrationally doing so based on some sort of supremacist type of view, I think. Give us one more. Give us a couple more, actually.
The second one I really enjoyed reading for obvious reason was the United Airlines decision to mandate and push for the vaccine across the board of the organization, because I think it's stirring a lot of questions, especially in the US, around what can be done, not be done, should be done, and so on. I strongly believe they're making the right decision, but that's a personal opinion. I think it's a good read, and it's very reflective. This one I enjoyed. I enjoyed the do-do-do-do-do.
Give me 2 seconds on this, Nico. Yeah. This is actually a really political... I don't know whether the same thing is happening in Europe and Denmark and UK and stuff like this, but it seems that the argument as to whether you should or should not vaccinate your employees is much more intense in the US than it is in different places, because there is a situation where you see prominent bosses saying you're getting vaccinated, and then it blows up in the media and people are rioting, people are saying this is a terrible imposition, etc. And it's very, very tough. Now, United Airlines, what triggered the boss, the CEO of the company, to make this decision was because one of their pilots actually contracted COVID as a result of obviously doing something quite dangerous. He's in an enclosed tube all the time. He's flying in a plane and he's interacting with cabin staff. He's interacting with other people that may not be vaccinated. And he ended up sort of being very, very ill. So the boss basically said, you know what, every single employee is going to be vaccinated. And if that's not right for you, you know what? There's another business out there that isn't making that rule, and you can go and work for those companies, but everyone in our company is going to be vaccinated. And it's actually driven vaccination rates up for the companies that have done this. So it seems that the argument is kind of being won, but it's still super political. And
it's very political. Should an organization impose something that,
thank you, Andrew,
in some country is seen as a you know, freedom of choice? Actually, it should be freedom of choice in every organization. In every country, right? It's your responsibility to want and do it. And I think where you're right is that the US, from what I perceive or see here based in Denmark, is that it's a much, much bigger discussion around, like, I want to do it or not want to do it than I leave every day in Denmark. Here it's just, I mean, I don't think I've met one person that doesn't want to do it.
Yeah. I think it's the same thing in Europe generally. It's less it's less of an imposition. I think there's kind of an interest in getting the vaccine generally. So the population is up for it. But there is a big question. I haven't seen any company say, or I can't remember any company say by mandate this is happening. But it seems to be that's the case in the US, and you know, there's controversy all the way through. There was even a non-vaccination job board. Did you see this a couple of weeks ago?
No, I didn't. Okay, if there's a way to do business, somebody's going to find a way to do business. So
right, I was amazed at seeing this, but apparently there's a job board for companies that don't have a vaccine mandate. So for all those folks who, you know, have a problem with their company saying you should be vaccinated and you've left that job and you want to go and work for another company that doesn't mandate this,
it's smart.
There's a job board for you.
I don't agree with it, but it's smart.
It's crazy. Anyway, I think really interesting politically. And again, it's like another thing that bosses and HR people, TA people have to deal with. Like when you're interviewing candidates, for instance, let's say we go back to face-to-face, if we ever do that, like one of the problems might be public health. Like, are you going to ask for a vaccination passport before the person comes on site? What do you do if he refuses or she refuses? Do you reject that person? Does that person then sue you for discrimination? Don't know.
It's super interesting. It's just to see. Very, very interesting. I had two more that I really enjoyed reading. I had the one on the productivity illusion, office or home. And that's linked to a discussion that I've had yesterday, because in a few weeks, I'll be talking at HR TechX here in Copenhagen, and I'll share the panel with two extremely smart, talented, experienced guy, one from Philips, one from Lego. And from Philips, he was saying that Philips is back to what they've decided to do like 3 days in the office and 2 days working from home. And the reason why for people to come to the office is for creativity, not for productivity. His point of view was that, or his personal experience was that he's more productive when he's working remote. But for creativity purposes, when you have to do a team brainstorming, teamwork and everything, then nothing beats the office, because nothing beats sitting across from each other and spending time together. And I mean, I've tried doing like a brainstorming session remote in video. It's personally a nightmare. It doesn't work for me, but maybe it works for other people. So I thought that was a super interesting read again that makes reflective. And then the one I really enjoyed for a personal experience in an organization that I worked at was that the talent shortage, credential inflation, about finding the A player, or what is an A player, and do you hire A player? Do they grow within your organization just as a part of evolution because they're the best tailored for the ecosystem that you have within the organization and everything? I thought that was super interesting and reflective as well on looking at recruitment and personal development in an organization and everything.
Yeah. And two really interesting and really smart authors as well. Like you get, I mean, obviously that's the point of brain food to really get some.
It's almost like you do a good job, huh? I mean,
it's like if someone who's writing something that's intimidating me smart, that's brain food.
Yeah.
It caused my brain to hurt a little bit. Okay. That's probably something I should put in. But they're both really, really good angles on what might be called, I wouldn't say tired topics, but the topics we talk about all the time, but sometimes you just take a different angle on it and mm-hmm. it becomes suddenly refreshing again. And the question that the first author was talking about was, look, productivity is the wrong thing to think about when you're looking at location. You're looking at, you know, it's not about what is productivity, she even asked, like what actually do you think it is? It's like suddenly we can't answer that question. It is actually about what is the product creative output. How creative are you? It's much more important, the innovation that comes out. And in mm-hmm. fact, you may need different contexts for innovation. And I agree, in person is, I think, stronger for innovation, for brainstorming, for getting stuff done, sort of that unstructured stuff done. It seems to be better. And for obviously the A player side, I think that's been a topic that Kevin Wheeler has been talking about a long time. Like, how do you actually know what an A player is? You can't actually know unless you've worked with that person in that context, because he used the sports analogy, which I'm sure you and I, you know, being sports fans would understand, is like, you know, star player from team A goes to join team B, and guess mm-hmm. what? He's in the subs bench, can't get on the field. Mm-hmm. You know, he hasn't got worse as a player. Probably
different system, different environment. Yeah.
Yeah. Totally. And it transforms his utility to the group. So, you know, which is, by the way, why Cristiano Ronaldo is better than Lionel Messi.
You know what? I agree. I was always a Messi fan. Well, Cristiano is proving in multiple teams, in multiple style of plays, in multiple countries, that he performs systematically. I mean, like constantly. So like, in terms of, you know what, in terms of productivity, of what is the best for the results of the organization that is joining, you would argue that is the best if we're looking at this as the assessment of what is the best.
That's the measure. That's the measure. Cristiano basically is the best player in every team he's played for, and he elevates every single team he plays for.
Second best player ever in the history of football after Zidane. But that's obviously a personal...
dude. Gaza is better than Zidane. For me, this is clear.
This is good.
Okay. We've got to get on with it. Let's talk about this. Let's bring on our guests because, you know, people didn't sign up to this to listen to us
discuss
talk
football.
About Gaza.
Yeah.
But maybe you did. I don't know. I mean,
we should do one day a brain food, correlation between sports and. There's actually about the vaccination that we discussed with United Airlines. There's an NBA player that just doesn't want to be vaccinated. And I think he's put on the bench, right? They don't want to let him play, which is the same logic.
Well, you know what? Sports is even more interesting because there's a huge risk. Because obviously, if you turn up and you're not vaccinated, you're an elevated risk of infecting your teammates. And if you infect a bunch of teammates, actually that has a direct impact on their performance next week. And that actually might have an impact on their ability to function as a business.
Yeah, I understand a lot.
It's almost like an extreme version of...
But does that mean that a sports player is not free anymore to make their own choice about what they want? I mean, we could go on.
Diving into the philosophy. Anyway, we've got Nims on the show. Welcome back, Nims. Great to see you. And for the people who don't know you, Nims, can you quickly introduce yourself?
Sure, of course I can. So hello everybody, my name's Nims and I'm an organization design and development partner at the MOD.
Amazing. Great to have you back, Nims. And by the way, I was gonna say before Stan turned up, I love your hair. It looks really good on camera. It's fantastic. The reason why I was prompted to say this is because I love Stan's hair also. He's got a new haircut. It looks great. Nico, you and
Nico.
I, we need to step away from
this.
It's a choice. Yeah. Anyway, Stan, good to see you. Can you quickly introduce yourself to the folks who don't know you?
Good to see you as well, Han. I'm Stan. I work for Smart Recruiters, a market-leading talent acquisition suite, and I run partnerships for them in EMEA.
Fantastic. And it's great to have you both on the show because we both had conversations about this topic in different sort of formats. I thought we'd be a great crowd to try and knock this one around a little bit. I'm not sure whether you heard sort of the earlier part of the show, and I was talking about the context of why this conversation I wanted to have was my looking at how the entire concept of culture in recruiting was that from 2011 to 2015 is my measurement of it. It seemed to be the only way in which you're able to recruit or you should recruit is culture, culture, culture. That's the only way you should do it. Stop looking at CV, stop looking at technical testing. We're only hiring people that fit our culture. That was the conversation. And then it's like, it felt like a meteorite. It's like suddenly, oh, you can't do that because if you're doing hiring for culture, actually, that's discriminatory. Actually, you're just going to hire people that are like you and not like others. We can't even do that. So I want to explore where we think the word culture is and where does it fit in our recruiting process. Can we do it? If we are going to do it, how do we do it? Do we do it anyway without admitting it? You know, where are we with it? So Nims, let's go with you on this. I mean, do you share my view of where the conversation has evolved on culture? How does it look like from the public sector, from these big organizations, you know, in your career path?
So from the public sector perspective, public civil service does not recruit for culture at all. We recruit for skills and we look at certain behaviors and all of that is publicly available. So you can go on the civil service, you can look at what the behaviors are and what level is expected. My personal opinion is I'm on the fence with some of this stuff. And I agree, I think people do it implicitly, but they're not going to obviously admit it, right? And some of them might be unconsciously doing it, but still doing it. We don't know. And they probably know because it's unconscious. But the gripes that I've got is the fact that we, I feel organizations have a poor understanding of their culture, and they're recruiting for a culture that they say exists, but in reality doesn't.
Right. So they have a kind of a idealized, dreamed up view of what their culture is, and they recruit against this, but it's a romantic fantasy. It's like, pretty that's much. Not what's the case. Yeah.
Beautiful words, beautiful words on the wall.
Yeah, it's that's what I see all the time. Beautiful words on the wall. And I'm like, getting to an organization, and actually some of it is kind of true, but a lot of it is like not true at all. And the other problem that I've got is, if you're going to talk about your culture, what's the dark side of your culture? What is the stuff that you don't do well? And why aren't you being honest with, like, these are the people we're looking for, but you've got to put up with this crap also if you want to join our organization.
Wow, that's some really important stuff. I mean, two things I thought were really interesting. We'll explore that in a moment. But the first thing that was interesting, just to remind myself, is there's a gap between the rhetoric about culture and the reality of culture. Do you agree with that, folks? Let me know whether that's the case. Have you experienced a situation where you've heard the talk on the culture, but then you've encountered an episode whilst you're in the business that you think, hang about, this is like totally not what the thing is? That would be interesting to hear from your opinion on that. And the second thing that you mentioned that was interesting was, maybe it's actually useful to expose some of the stuff that is certainly part of your culture, but not something that you would advertise, but it's honest. It's to say, you know what, this happens. We were working on it, but you need to be aware, if you're coming into this, it's going to be a little bit like this. This is part of, you know, our journey as we go forward. So definitely something to explore. Stan, moving over to you, what is your view on the conversation about culture? Like, how has it evolved? Where has it gone and where it is? Because I think you and I, probably all four of us here, probably share kind of a similar level of experience in recruiting. We've been doing it for like 10 years plus, right? So we've seen the conversation evolve over that time. What's your kind of understanding of the how it's evolved as a topic of conversation?
In my opinion, we have to step our game up. I'm not on the fence at all about culture. I think it's one of the key denominators for success and failure in business. And I think we need to start hiring for it much more. Hiring for skills without defining, a good point there. I think too many comments. I think Baker. Defining it needs to become more empirical, more scientific. And if we manage to do that, then we will change people's lives. We'll change people's lives. We'll see different behavior, all the 1 year, 2 year job hopping, you know, coming in somewhere super happy and then quickly finding out, ooh, I'm actually not comfortable here at all. There's a way to beat that if we step our culture game up.
So why do you think that's the case, Dan? I mean, basically, are you saying, are we averse to talking about culture as something that we use to assess people? Like, what's your explanation or theory as to why we need to step, why the situation is as bad as you say?
I think there are a lot of opinions about culture, and there are a few people that have really put in the effort to research it, you know, scientifically. And the people and the much of the content that they've produced, I think the recruitment world is far too unfamiliar with it. And if we step our game up, we educate ourselves, I think we'll have a much more sophisticated discussion about culture. And the misconception that culture, hiring for culture, drives inequality, you know, that sort of stuff, involving things like race, religious background, gender in culture, which are completely different topics. Obviously, they overlap, but they're completely different topics. If we change that narrative and our thinking around culture, then we'll become much, much better at it. And the content is there. We just need to get with it, get with the program.
All right. Very, just, very interesting. Go ahead, Nico.
Yeah, Stan. So, like, I just want to make sure I understand. You're saying that, obviously, so culture should be part of the recruitment process. I'm 100% with you, and saying that you're not taking into account anyone that's saying they're not, they're lying to themselves. So I'm with you on this one. Are you saying that it is important to hire for a culture alignment? Culture, I hate the term culture fit, so I'm trying not to use it, but like a culture alignment. And because what you're saying is that culture is what's, I'm just repeating what you said, culture is what's going to define your failure or your success as an organization.
Yeah, no, not just as an organization, as a team, as an individual. If you as an individual are thrown into a culture where you do not fit at all, you'll have a bad time. It's like me at the salsa party, you know, everyone's having a good time dancing and I'm in the corner like, damn, I should have done more than three courses, you know, right?
I think everyone can agree with that. Stan, I think everyone can agree with the fact that sometimes you are in a group of people where you are not aligned with the culture of that group of people. I think we've all been in that situation, right? Haven't we? I mean, in that scenario, if that bunch of people set up a company, I would want to know that my culture doesn't fit in there, because dropping me in there is actually a really bad thing. I don't want to be any part of that. So
or David Beiser has a good one there about heterogeneity. It doesn't have to, you know, culture fit doesn't have to become a synonym for the sameness. Let me give you an example of two actual companies in Holland. You can probably hear by my accent, I'm Dutch. Both have a lion in their logo. Both are Dutch, both orange, both are in finance and banking. They couldn't be more similar. They're both hiring everything that the bank is hiring, you know, fintech, sales, consultants, etc. Rabobank and ING. Culturally, they could not be more different. You know, if you have a wonderful career at Rabobank, it's a very traditional local for local bank, culturally, you go into this, you know, agile, fast-moving tech style managed and cultural company that's ING, it'll clash, and vice versa. So on paper for a bot or for a matching algorithm, these companies are essentially the same. But actually, in practice, they're completely different than the people that are there. And these are diverse people, by the way. These are not just men, just women, just the same ethnicity, just the same hobbies. No, these are people with a very broad spectrum of things that they like to do and where they're from and who they are, how old they are. But the culture of these companies is completely different. And we need to start appreciating that. IBM and Microsoft, right. You know.
This goes all the way back to Nim's first point, which was like we have a rhetorical treatment of culture, and all the rhetorical becomes cliche, by the way, because it's all like, yes, we're flat structure with this and this. It's all like literally you could do a mini word cloud and it would be the same words. But there is cultural difference in reality in terms of how different organizations operate. Now, how can we actually get beyond the rhetoric and figure out the reality? Nims, you've actually done some work on this, haven't you? This is actually your professional thing. So give us some ideas how we go about doing that. Yeah, there's a bunch of recruiters, TA people working in companies now. They would have no clue how to get beyond the rhetoric and to get to reality. So how do they actually understand what the culture is in the company? How would they do it?
So what we do in the civil services, we have an intervention called the Culture Inquiry. And what the Culture Inquiry is about is understanding the organization through forms of storytelling. What do people say about the organization? What stories do they tell about the organization? And that is where you get the culture from their experiences, because our experiences are hooked into our stories and what happens in organizations. If you can extract the stories and form a pattern, where are the same stories turning up? Where are we getting commonality and where are we getting differences? You get a picture of what the organizational story is, i.e. the organizational culture.
All right, so that sounds to me like a qualitative data collection exercise, and it's probably a survey, isn't it? Like you send people something to say, right, fill this in. No?
It's not a survey. It's getting people in a room or on Teams or on Zoom, having a conversation. We use like virtual whiteboards, people stick stuff on. It is qualitative, but then we turn that into quantitative data. So, you know, what are the most common themes that are mentioned? What is the words that are used? Where are the, so we do the groups and themes encoding in all of our content, and then we build a picture of what the narrative of the organization really is.
That's really interesting. So you even doing some word analysis, like what are the terms people tend to surface up and use? Because that words carry the culture, right? So the people, you know, you about to say something?
Yeah. And what we also do is what we notice, like what's happening in the culture inquiry, how are people's behaviors? Are they really talkative? Are they not? Do we feel as facilitators that they're holding back? They're not telling the truth. Is this a safe space for them? And then we kind of be able to add that into our inquiry in terms of actually there's something much deeper happening with this organization or with this group or team.
that's something that Andrew just mentioned there. He said that what if there's a negative story, people might not feel as if they could surface that up. So how do you make sure that those people are able to speak, or that information is able to be collected?
So we design it in a way where we are grouping people, you know, so for example, MOD or any civil service, quite hierarchical. So we group people in the relevant grades or grade structures to extract the stories to create the safe environment. Even then, we still get reluctance for people sharing what's really going on. It's up to the facilitators, i.e. me or my colleagues, to pick that up and notice that. So we do make notes about, you know, the fact that this isn't a safe place, or there are some stories and we're just getting, you know, the top of the iceberg from that perspective, but it's a hell of a lot deeper than what's posted on the walls on a website.
Right. Very, very good. To stick on this just while a posted little bit
on
longer.
The wall and the website. I love this.
Yeah, there's one more thing I want to ask. Basically, what are the questions that would trigger the storytelling? Because I think that part of the skill is, you know, what is the question?
The question is, it's really simple. So what we do is we have, this is a place where we are your people, and they fill it in. So it is completely open to interpretation. You can say, this is a place where I am developed. This is a place where I feel as if I can have a voice, or this is a place where, you know, hierarchy wins.
All right. Rewind that back, folks. Basically, you start a question and then have the person like autofill it, essentially. This is a place where, and then you got free text, and then that will tell you how you feel about the organization. Stan, you about to say something?
Yeah, because if people are interested in this, that there isn't a better, I think, piece of content than Erin Meyer's book called The Culture Map. She has got a PhD thanks for this, by doing this research, and she identifies pretty much 7 segments that define a culture. And I'll read them up because I don't know them by heart. But communication is one, direct or indirect. Try having a conversation, a management conversation in a Japanese boardroom and in an American. Completely different dynamic. Evaluation, are you evaluated in front of your colleagues? Even negative feedback, which is fine in Holland. But if you do that in some other countries, it's massive disrespect. People will be really hurt. That's culture. Leading, is it very hierarchical? You just mentioned it, Nims, or is it egalitarian? Deciding, is that top down or is it consensual? Trusting, is it task oriented or relationship based? And then finally, disagreeing and scheduling, how is that managed? You know, is it flexible time, linear time? Example, again, ING is known for its very flexible work culture. Rabobank is 9 to 5, exactly the same type of company on paper, completely different work culture. You send an email to someone at Rabobank at 9 p.m. and you offended them. You do it at ING, it's totally normal. Those 7 elements define the culture.
You know what? I think that Erin Meyer structure, she's actually probably the most famous crossover person, I think, in our space. In other words, like a half anthropologist, half work consultant person. And she's written a really popular book, I think it's called The Culture Map. And she creates these kind of cultural personas as to, generally speaking, you know, this is how it operates in different countries. I think really interesting to review. And her structure, I think, might be something that's worth just documenting, because it could be a useful framework for us to analyze our own company cultures. Because, and that could combine very well with the qualitative work that NIMS is doing. So in other words, let's surface out what people are really thinking, and then we can kind of have a look at how our structures are either encouraging or discouraging or promoting some of these behaviors or feelings. Because I do think it's possible, it's totally possible to engineer a culture in some way, or at least to create a system which creates or encourages behaviors, which then generates it manifests itself in ways that we would describe as culture. Nico, let's not be quiet on this. I know that sort of...
What you just said, like because of the nature of Platypus, we have data now on this, about like company culture, what we see in certain organizations. And because of the granularity of the tool, we have data
Rewind back. What is the data you're collecting again? I forget.
We ask, it's a little bit like Erin, it's a little bit of Schneider and Denison as well, because they are pretty good as well in terms of PhD dudes that have written stuff on company culture and so on. But basically what we do in a way it's Nims and I talked about this in the past when we looked together a little bit at Platypus, is we try of like asking basically every single employee to reflect on what is important to them, what's going to drive them in terms of their culture, what do they care for. You know, we have 12 core cultural drivers, and basically they have the room anonymously to think about, you know what, this is what's important to me. Because our concept is that the stuff that Nims and I love, you know, the beautiful words on the wall, or like what I call the beautiful corporate values that absolutely not define the culture of an organization, is autocratic. And our view is that culture is democratic. Every single person with what is important to them, a bit like what you said, Stan, around Erin, impacts the culture of an organization. So it's about giving the room to the person anonymously. That's the difference with Nims, but anonymously to build a cultural heat map of what they care for, and then aggregate all these data from every single employee with an algorithm that we've put in place. Because yes, everyone impacts the culture. I think we would be lying if we would say everyone has the same impact on the culture. That's you know, unfortunately, not true. And then we're capable of basically giving cultural map of organizations. We have companies currently using us in Europe, Asia, and the US. And the beauty of it is to then being able to follow, not only in customer success, but with like satisfaction surveys around, this is important to you as a subgroup of person, because we can granularly look at what's my subculture in Copenhagen tech versus London marketing and so on, all your sub departments, and follow that with a satisfaction on what is important to me. Because that tells you then, is the culture the perceived culture, the wanted culture, and am I aligned with you know, what is important to me in the organization? That's where it becomes super important. And where I was going Stan was saying around, like, you know, the behavior linked to what is important to you. We see this in our current customers that obviously I cannot share because I don't want to go to GDPR jail, you know, like, not nice. But we see massive differences in organization, just like you're describing with the two Dutch giants. When you said, like, you know, they're orange with the lion on thing, I thought you were talking about the national team in football. But, yeah.
Every company in Holland mandatorily has to have an orange lion.
Orange and a lion. Yeah. But it is so, and I think linking to, you know, the discussion that we're having at the start, like a culture in the recruitment process, the fit or whatever. I think what you said, it used to be all about culture. Culture hit breakfast, like a strategy for breakfast. We hire for culture, not for skills. Everyone said this. Everyone was lying, but everyone said this. I think now it's more around, I don't like the term culture fit. I don't think you hire for culture fit. I think you look at where are we close and where are we not close, and how do we best work together, and what will be the impact that you bring in the subculture of my team. And
all right, go ahead, Stan.
That was so spot on when you said subculture of my team. I think that's where you nailed it. You nailed it, because what really annoys me as a marketer,
I like you, Stan.
Yeah, what really annoys me as a marketer, and used to annoy me a lot when we created campaigns for corporates, is that they were trying to market their company. You know, if you're an international company, you're already done. Every country will engage differently with the content you produce. But then on the team level, there are huge differences. Yeah. What, if you don't believe me, anyone listen to this, be a fly on the wall when we go back to the office, or in your Slack channel of that specific team, in your marketing team's department, or in their Slack channel, and then do the same thing in your bookkeeping's department. And I'm pretty sure you will see some minor differences between the interaction. Same goes for sales and engineering. You can have multiple subcultures within the wider organization, and the better you can identify, at that point you can hire talent and match it where it adds value, indeed. But you can't put someone in a team that loves to go out for drinks every day when you hate that. You want to keep a bit of a distance from your colleagues. That's the culture you want. If you put someone like that in a team that's like, yeah, we're going out again, we're getting wasted, you're going to have that person's going to have a bad time. It won't work no matter how much you try.
Okay, let me just intercede here. Firstly, I'm a big fan of being able to pick up like all of the metadata that's occurring within businesses these days, because we're all digital. That means there's a huge digital exhaust that's being created in terms of how we communicate. We can mine that information and we can actually figure out how different teams operate. So you mentioned things like, oh, how different departments have, you know, these Slack channels. Well, actually, you could probably count the number of interactions in these Slack channels per person, or you could count how long those interactions are. Like, do people type long considered messages, or is it like emoticons or whatever? And you could make some general assessments to say, you know what, this is a very light and friendly type of environment. They're doing a lot of chatting on work. That's all cool. This is super serious. The Slack channel, like, it's heavily bleed. That tells you a lot. However, that gets us into all kinds of privacy issues and all those types of conversations about, you know, bossware and stuff. Leaving that conversation to one side, but I think we can and do have the information to figure out
subculturally
where we're at. Nico, you mentioned something earlier about the hiring side, and Stan, you touched upon it as well. Nims, let's bring you into this conversation also. Like, how does it actually get to the point where we're hiring somebody and we think that person is not going to fit in with the subculture of the team? Now, this person has technically kicked the ass out of it. Amazing. CVs there, profiles there. All of it's telling me, yeah, this should be a tick in the box. But I know this person is going to be a disaster. Sometimes you put someone in the team, it's just not going to gel. It's actually going to be very destructive. What are we advising that person? Because we are well into the thick of the weeds of discrimination here. How do we separate this understanding of this person not aligning with the culture, or I guess this person not aligning with the culture, and discrimination? Or is discrimination just a heuristic for culture fit? How do we do that?
I have no idea. I think it's a messy question. I really don't have the answer to that, because I think that to put it down and articulate it is a story that we tell ourselves, that, oh, we're doing it because they're not going to fit into our culture. And I wonder if you ask people, is that really true? I mean, deep down, what are they afraid of? Conflict, the team going down? Like, there's much more deeper meanings that we are putting on to say, oh, this person's going to be the wrong fit, because they don't want to piss off their teammates for hiring the wrong person, because they don't want to manage this person. You know, what's the real reason? And let's just get on with it and put our big boy pants on and say, this is what the problem is going to be, because that's what I noticed. I think there's actually underlying issues that prevent us from hiring. And perhaps, you know, we're afraid of it. What are teams scared of, right? From difference, from
is it not legitimate, not though? Like, let's say I hire someone and I know this person will piss off the rest of the team. Isn't that not a legitimate decision as a manager? I'm thinking, you know what, this person may give me a plus one in terms of their own performance, but they're going to lead to minus three from everyone else. My entire unit is going to go worse. No go. Isn't that like a legit call?
No, because I'd say you need to sort out your conflict management skills, and so do the team, right? I'm sorry, but you adults. Do.
You're right.
Fair enough. We're adults, and we need to be able to, you know, sort out our differences, not like children do in the playground, but as adults do, and saying, you know, we need to stop being so polite about stuff and say, this is what's not working, and treat the other person like an adult and a human being.
Right. Yeah, I think that's totally fair point. Go ahead, Stan.
There's a good comment from Christy there, which I believe with until the word surprise is used. Because yes, you know, I fully believe that it's interesting to throw someone with a different type of cultural preference into a dynamic and see what kind of new dynamic is created. You know, that's how we evolved from amoebas to where we are right now, having a digital conversation, you know, through these mutations.
And Nims is right. But it's the responsibility of the manager.
Yeah, exactly. We don't have to be surprised anymore. With tools like Platypus, with tools like Company Match, and with other empirical data and analysis and assessment tools we can use up front, we can actually see if this could work. But there's another thing that we can do without any technology. And that's actually taking that person and bringing that person to the team and having them spend 3 days with the team, you know, maybe working on a project together, design sprint together, or maybe coding a little bit together, or maybe working on some kind of commercial go-to-market idea together, and just see how the collaboration goes. And then instead of us being the person that rejects someone because of cultural fit, we can actually go like, hey, hun, what do you think? Will you survive here or would you hate it here? And then hun goes, you know what? Honestly, after these 3 days, I don't feel like I'm really a great fit for this culture. Then it's actually Hun that can choose. And right now everyone's hiring, right? So it's probably even better for Hunt to realize, or the recruiter to say, like, hey, you'd probably hate it here, and Hunt to find a place where he's happy and will stay for a long time, instead of having to job hop after 6 months, 1 year, to another company blindfolded every time, only to find out later that it wasn't a fit.
All right. So I think the idea of, like, literally getting a work trial in is obviously the best way to figure this out, right? Because it's better than any kind of proxy that you've got. You've literally got a period of time where the person's interacting. I think that's probably true.
However, practically,
that's really difficult.
Logistically, it's not always possible. I mean, like, I love the idea. That's the best case scenario with everything, right? But I think as well, like, on top of this, and I'll rebound on what Nim said, it's 100% of, the responsibility of the manager. If you decide, like, let's kill culture fit because it's wrong and it's disgusting, and it's about culture ad or culture alignment or whatever, but it's 100% the responsibility of the manager that people should work well together. That's my job. That's why I'm paid, to put people in the best situation possible to perform. That's why I'm the manager, right? So crisis management or multicultural training or accepting differences. But Nims, like, your thing around, like, people should be adults, I think I give up on this one. I mean, I don't just, yeah.
What do you mean you give up on that one?
I think, like, one line I love to use is, like, common sense, not so that common. So I give up on this, that, like...
Nico, have more faith in humanity, please.
I'm French, obviously not.
All right.
But I want to add one thing. Go ahead, Nims. I do not fit into the MOD culture. Absolutely not. But I am thriving in that culture.
Because you love to change things.
Because I love to change things. And I bring creative tension in my role. Yeah. Right? I add the difference. I do not fit in 100%. My leg is always halfway out the door. Right? But I'm there because of the challenge. Right? And I'm there because I'm provocative.
Yeah.
All right, let's now move on to a different way. Thank you for everyone's contribution there, by the way. Let's move on to the next stage. So we've got a bunch of people listening to this and they're thinking, all right, this is great. I need to understand my culture better. We've got some ideas as to how to do that, whether it's through using tooling or using a more qualitative way of surfacing up this information, all kinds of ways to figure this out. How do we actually implement something in the recruiting process that's going to help us, like, understand the alignment that this person has with the existing culture? And not to say we're going to say disalignment means a veto, but it helps the hiring manager and the team understand what else needs to happen in order for this new person to potentially succeed. So I may, for instance, hire someone who is a complete maverick, let's say. Needs to drive the car, needs to do their own thing, isn't really gonna, be fit into a narrow scope type of role. That's great, but how do I figure that out in a way that isn't just my gut feel? Is there some sort of way in which we could do that in the assessment flow or whatnot? Any thoughts on this? Nims, go with you on this first.
You're asking about their preferences.
No, I'm asking about how do we understand the cultural alignment aspect process.
To me, you ask them what their preferences are. How do you like to be managed?
All right, I'm
gonna ask it straight out in terms of what I know about my organization and my culture, and then actually what are their preferences, what's really important to them in a working environment, how do they like to operate, do they like to be managed closely, or do they like, like you said, like lots of free reign, they want to drive the car themselves. Pretty much like me, leave me alone and just let me get on with it and I'll do my job. Or do they want something, a little bit more support? So I'd be right out and say, just ask the questions about their preferences instead of relying on your gut feel.
Staying with that just a little bit as a follow-up question, Nims, I think that's a really good way to address that first issue. How would you then communicate a lack of cultural alignment? So I've asked you the question. Okay, Nims, what do you reckon? You want? What do you want? You've given me a list of things. I've got the information. It's great. It's not aligned to this particular context I've got. How do I kind of express that to the candidate?
Yeah, but you're making an assumption that I actually hire for cultural fit, and you're definitely asking the wrong person. So not a question that I would be willing to answer either way, but I wouldn't take it into account. I'd want to know their preferences, but then I'd work out my style. according to their needs, right? And I would help my team to understand what their needs are. So for me, a lot of it about changing the culture is about changing the interactions and how people interact within a team and how to accommodate and bring people in. Because that person who I'm hiring that doesn't actually fit or align to my culture can be bringing something that this team badly needs and I just don't know it yet.
100%. That's true. I do think that's true. But the alternative side to this is also this person may be a danger to the team in some way. In other words, they may come in. You can't be overly accommodating all the time to every new person.
That's why there's a probation. That's what said. There's a probation period. There's a probation period.
I'm not overly accommodating because I have no problems telling my candidates about what the boundaries are and how we work. Sure, I want a collaborative environment, but we work with respect and, you know, understanding our boundaries. So for me, it's about helping that person understand the boundaries and how we work and, you know, where are their boundaries in all of this and how can we create a much more collective picture of how we want to work in addition to meeting some of their needs.
Yeah. Oh, shit. Sorry. I forgot one thing. And one thing that we always try and do on this show is to make sure that we are not the bottleneck for this conversation, folks. So if you've enjoyed talking about culture and you want to connect with everybody, please take a moment to share your LinkedIn profile in the chat stream right now. And then make sure you can go and connect with everyone else that's part of this conversation, whether it's on the panel or in the chat stream or whatever. I think if this topic's interesting to you, it's also interesting to all of the other people that signed in and watching the show. So make sure you connect with those folks and give yourself the opportunity to follow up this conversation at another moment when we conclude this. So go ahead and put it in the chat stream now. Nico, let's go with you on this. So Nimbus is basically saying, okay, great. You can sort of surface up the person's self-awareness of their own behavior. I mean, let's assume they know that, but you can surface up by a direct question. How would your approach be if you wanted to express to that person, you know what, there isn't really a very close alignment with how this person prefers to operate and how we as a business or we as a team operate?
I mean, I don't want, I'm not a believer of hiring for a culture fit or culture match. I'm a big believer of shake things up and create a cultural diversity, bring people that are going to think differently, that I care for different things, because my goal, and I'm looking at me personally, at Platypus in my organization, is to have the most diverse culture possible, because I'm building a tool that's supposed to be used by everyone. Everyone should be able to connect with Platypus, and in order for everyone to be able to use my product, I need my culture to be able to represent everyone. So for me, it's never about when we hire here, it's never about looking at cultural fit, but it's about having data for me to understand better what Nim is saying. What is important to that person, not important to that person? How is that correlating to the team that they're going to join? If I have that data, then I can have like a proper discussion of like, this is what you'd experience here in that team with those people. How do we best make it work moving forward?
All right. I think that's actually a really good line to use. Like, this is what you would experience here. And obviously, you would hopefully know that information, not from the rhetoric, but you might have gone through an exercise where you've surfaced the reality of it. And then you can really say, or even done the meta-analysis of it, you know, you can understand, you know, how people communicate and talk and all that type of stuff. So you can literally say, you know what, this is generally what happens if you join our company or join this team, you can experience these things. And that person needs to be fully aware of it. Even if it means that there could be some modification of behavior one way or the other in order to get in there. Okay, same question to you, Stan. Here's the scenario. You've interviewed somebody, you're in the process of interviewing. There is a lack of alignment in terms of what you think this person's preferred mode of operating is and what your team's mode of operating is. How would you kind of express this difference to this person?
So I've been battling hard here for a culture fit and culture match, or however you call it semantically, but my personal opinion is, when push comes to shove, we're not looking either for skills alone or culture alone. We're looking for chemistry, actual chemistry. So what I would discuss with this person and would try to find out with this person is how much chemistry there is. So I actually, you know, I love to shake things up as well. I also love, you know, when people or where certain things are a shoe-in. You know, this will fit like a glove, right? But in a recruitment conversation, you really do want to know, you do want to try and assess through assessments, through trial periods, whether there's chemistry or not, because that will be the difference maker between succeeding or failing as a business and as an individual.
And you know what? Chemistry is a term we use to describe relationships a lot, but it actually may be biochemical.
It's biochemical, right?
Yeah, like the olfactory senses are actually hugely relevant. Now, this actually has a huge implication in terms of where we're at with distributed working, because obviously we can't smell through a computer. We're lacking a lot of the other things that we would pick up in an in-person situation. So theoretically, and again, this is like maybe moving towards more controversial position, but maybe a distributed workforce, perhaps the cultural fit is going to look very different. Like the idea of cultural matching or cultural alignment perhaps could be very, very different, maybe less significant than being in a room together 9 to 5, 5 days a week. I disagree.
I strongly disagree, Hung. Okay. Finally, something we disagree upon. I'm tired of agreeing with you. Seriously. I think understanding the culture is even more important because less tangible when you're remote. We have some of our customers that are fully remote organizations, and that is the idea of why they're using a Platypus, to really better understand the data. It's easier to feel it and understand it when we're all sitting in the same room. It will be much faster to understand because we're sitting next to each other, and you will start seeing me behaving a certain way for 8 to 9 hours per day, and you'll understand much, much faster. So it's more critical to understand when you have remote or some of your team members that are remote, what actually drives those people and what is the culture, and way more important to describe it and share it in the recruitment process. In my view.
You know what? One thing I need to say, I'd really love to see some more data coming from Platypus. I don't know whether you produced any of this publicly, Nico, but I'd be very interested to know like some of the stuff, obviously anonymized and what have you, but I think that could really help evidentialize some of these things and help people figure it out a little bit better. Because I still think we're a bit weak generally about this.
We've had some people using us. We've had some people that have shared their company print and their company cultural map and everything. I don't know if it's a good idea. I mean, I'm here to provide data. They decide what they do. Personally, I think it should be anonymous, but it's up to them. But we are looking before the end of the year, doing some white paper of what have we seen so far with the organization using us, aggregating all this data, showing some stuff, you know, per location, Scandinavia versus the US versus the UK, because we have customers there. What trends do we see? Yes.
I would love to see that, because I think there are obviously national differences, cultural differences, often driven by history, driven by law as well. That makes a huge difference. I think in the US organization, for instance, at-will contract is a basic thing. I think that's a hugely significant a legislation or a corporate rule that makes people's relationship with organizations very different. And that is totally different from a different place in a place, let's say, where you can't release people that easily. France, classic example. Maybe you'd create very different cultures by those things. We don't have the time, unfortunately, to get to the point of doing some social experimentation on company culture. I'd love to do this a little bit more. How can you create experiments to change how culture works? And drop in, let's say, a big rule. Oh, we're all doing this now. Suddenly, see how that impacts culture in some way. Treat your employees as guinea pigs, should we say? But we'll have to do that as a part B. Come on, why not? You know, have a bit of fun with your life. This is why we've got to end the show before I say anything more that might get me into trouble. Listen, let's leave it with a final comment from everybody. Is there one resource that you wish that other people will literally go ahead and read or get access to kind of increase their literacy with regards to company corporate culture? There's a lot of people watching this really being interested in the topic, but they may be looking for other ways to have a deeper dive. Is there one thing you would cite, say, okay, check this out? Nims, have you got any thoughts on this?
Yeah, I do. I would probably say look at Edgar Schein's work on culture.
Can you pick up a link on the book or something like that and share in chat stream names? That'd be super useful. Nico, let's go to you. Aside from platypus, like what else? What else?
I would never ever say this. Okay, that's not my.
What
style.
Else should they look at?
Like again, me personally, very much love Schneider and Denison. Whatever stuff they came out with in terms of the books, their vision and their view on culture within an organization. They've built great framework as well. I like it a lot.
Cool, cool. Share that link of something that they've done in the chat stream so people can go pick that up. Okay, outside of Erin Meyer, Stan, what else should people be looking at or experimenting with or picking up?
I like this company called Platypus. there you go. There's another one as well that I recommend people have a look at. It's called Company Match, and they have a culture assessment tool that's free for candidates to use. So if you have a team, they can just run the assessment completely free of charge, figure out what their culture is. Companies, if they then want to assess it for themselves, they do have to pay. So, but the free stuff is always good. So, have a look at
companies. I agree. I think it would be cool for companies to have a way to just produce it, because I think that, I wouldn't say we've got to dumb it down, but we have to make it more doable for someone who is a non-specialist. There's going to be too many people that are just essentially generalists trying to pour their way forwards. Can we help, put down another brick in the road for them to move forward? Anyway, this is it for the rest of the show. I think we have to do a round two and something like this. It's been a really interesting one to talk about. Sorry, we haven't actually got to the questions. We don't have the time for it. We'll have to regroup and revisit. Okay, that's about it, everybody. We are back next week. I forget what we're talking about. Oh, we might actually be going to India next week. We're going to do a virtual tour of recruiting in India. It's going to be at 9 a.m. because I'm going to do it in India time. So if you're interested in like one of the most dynamic markets that is happening in the world right now in terms of recruiting, and also I think one of the most unique, because a lot of the challenges that Indian recruiters have are literally nothing like the challenges that people outside of India have. Tune in for that show. It's going to be super interesting. We've got recruiters from Accenture, from Facebook, from Capgemini, and also some smaller organizations in India as well. They're going to tell us about, okay, this is what our problems are. It's going to be super fascinating. Okay, that's about it, everybody. Everybody have a good weekend. Nims, thank you so much for joining us on Brain Food Live. Great to have you. We'll catch up with you soon. And Stan, great to see you again. Say hi to the family. We'll see you soon, sir.
All the best. Bye-bye.
And Nico, thanks for co-piloting, man. Great to have you on the show as usual. And hopefully we'll catch up soon, dude.
Have a good one, my man.
Take it easy. Okay, folks, that's it. I hope you've enjoyed the show. If you have, followed the channel. We do this every Friday, usually at 2 p.m. BST. But next week, as I reminded you, I think we're going to do it at 9 a.m. I urge you to tune up for that if you're looking to better understand how different countries wrestle with some of these recruiting challenges. Okay, that's about it. Have a good weekend.